Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and this afternoon at 1 o'clock, I'll be moderating a panel for the Tribeca Film Festival as part of their series of discussions that are taking place around the film festival. It's free and open to the public in Lower Manhattan if you want to come. This panel is called Visions of History and Truth, Artists in Action After 9/11. And we will be talking mostly about the much-talked-about film that opened the festival last night, United 93, the real-time depiction of the 9/11 hijacking, the passenger heroism, and the ultimate crashing of that plane in Pennsylvania. I saw the movie yesterday. We're also going to do an open phones in about an hour for anybody else who saw it. And I was amazed by how much ripping of the government there was in that film, not just depiction of the heroism of the passengers and crew, but we'll get into that in an hour. And of course, this is the movie for which the trailer wound up being pulled at an Upper West Side theater after it was too intense for some in the audience. So we will have on this panel Lloyd Levin, a producer of United 93, David Allen Bache, one of the actors, and Anne Ho, curator of the September 11th documentary project from the Library of Congress. This is at the Tribeca Performing Arts Center, 199 Chambers Street, between West Street and Greenwich Street, at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And again, it is free and open to the public, sponsored by the Tribeca Film Festival. Well, so thinking about Jane Jacobs' model of mixed-use urban density, in perhaps no other neighborhood in the city today are the threads of deindustrialization, real estate development, the public interest, and art and artists woven together in so tight a pattern as in Dumbo. The waterfront area, down under the Manhattan Bridge overpass, if you never knew what Dumbo stood for, was a forgotten mix of empty warehouses, cobblestone streets, and the anchorages of the Manhattan and Brooklyn bridges when artists moved in once upon a time as they were pushed out of Soho. A local developer sped the process along by offering subsidized housing to the pioneering artists until the area was deemed ready for co-ops, condos, and Starbucks. Thanks in no small part to that same developer, art is still to be found in Dumbo today. And a show on view at the Smack Mellon Gallery presents artists' responses to forgotten, undeveloped, or pre-redeveloped urban spaces. And joining me now to talk about the show called Mind the Gap are Ava Diaz, a co-curator with Beth Stryker of the exhibit, and two representatives of the Center for Urban Pedagogy, or CUP, who are represented in the show by their work about the Fulton Street Mall. Damon Rich, co-founder and creative director of CUP, and he's joined by Rostin Wu, CUP's director of programs. So welcome to WNYC. Ava, Damon, Rostin, thanks a lot for coming in.
Oh, it's so nice to be here.
Ava, what do you mean by forgotten, or as you put it, residual urban spaces?
Well, in putting together this show, I was realizing how many artists were taking up the privatization of space in the city and looking at kind of interstitial or liminal zones in which to site art, and really in the absence of a kind of vibrant public art sphere where people can reliably site art, these interstitial zones or residual spaces became sites for art, and often in a clandestine or unauthorized manner. So, you know, and using the gallery as a platform for these projects and also having projects within the public sphere is a way to sort of activate these spaces that artists were already, you know, working on.
It's very Jane Jacobs of art to act that way, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I know one of the artists in the show, Michael Rakowitz, puts up car-shaped tents in parking spaces, tents in the shapes of cars, as a way of commenting on homelessness. Mm-hmm. Does much of the work in the show confront those kinds of issues head on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Rakowitz actually on Sunday is going to do a workshop called On Flexible Architecture, in which he's going to sort of, you know, have a public interaction about how to do these sort of clandestine homeless shelters that you can, you know, if you rented a parking space, you'd have a place to stay for the night. So, yeah, and there's another team, Sancho Silva and John Hawk, who have a bus stop that they sited in their neighborhood in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and, you know, sort of masquerading and as a public works project because it uses the orange netting and plywood and orange cones that's the kind of typical appearance of the infrastructure of the city. So they're actually providing a service, like a bus stop at a forlorn site in the city. So many of the projects are sort of doing that activation of space.
Damon, the Center for Urban Pedagogy, that's quite a mouthful. Would you describe CUP as an arts collective?
We've been called that, although our general identification is as a nonprofit group. We went through all the trouble of getting a 501c3 so that we actually do work ourselves, but we also offer opportunities to other artists and designers who do work under our umbrella.
And the word pedagogy would indicate that it's got something to do with education.
Exactly. Our mission statement is to do creative education about places and how they change. So that means we do exhibits, we actually work with youth in schools, and we do publications. And it's all about how decisions get made about the places that people live.
So tell us about your work in the show, Values and Variety, Shopping on Fulton Street, done in conjunction, I understand, with the Pratt Institute Center for Community and Environmental Development. Why Values and Variety? Why the Fulton Street Mall?
Well, maybe I'll field that one. I guess the reason why we picked the Fulton Mall was fomented by a decision in 2004. The Department of City Planning came out with a new plan for the kind of rezoning and development of that area. Basically, most of the adjacent areas to the Fulton Street, and Fulton Street between Adams and Flatbush, is basically what we'll consider Fulton Mall. And they put together this big plan to upzone it, put in maybe 6.5 million square feet of office space, and basically, you know, redevelop that area really significantly. And we thought that there is a lot of there's no specific plan made for the mall itself, but we figured that there is definitely going to be many changes that would come as a result of that, and as well as all the kind of development that's going to Brooklyn. And in making that process, we wanted to figure out ways to reach the folks who are using the mall to be active voices in shaping the way it's been redeveloped, because that space historically has been, I guess, redeveloped frequently without much concern for the existing constituency, usually redeveloped for other folks who they hope will bring to the space instead of developing it for the existing users.
So what do you think about the Fulton Street Mall today?
Well, I think it's a really vibrant, amazing place in Brooklyn, and it's definitely a place that I've had a lot of great memories and positive shopping experiences. And it's, I think, a place that, you know, it's funny because I think that it's often kind of seen by a certain constituency, the Brownstone Belt areas right around it, say Fort Greene or Brooklyn Heights. It's seen as a place that maybe needs some revitalization, but it's actually one of the most vibrant shopping areas in the city. I think it's the third largest shopping district. By some counts, 100,000 folks visit it every day.
Yeah. Describe the project. Describe the posters and where they are and things like that.
Sure. Well, the posters make use of kind of an infrastructure that was built in the 80s when they pedestrianized them all. They put in all these kiosks. And for a while, the kiosks had kind of become vacant. There was nothing in them for a while. And that was when we kind of decided, oh, it'd be interesting to do a poster project. There's already this great infrastructure there. And so what we tried to do is just make something very much in the tradition of historical signage, in a way, interpretive signage, helping people, understand what they see when they come to the mall. But instead of trying to connect solely back to, 19th century history, we tried to very much use recent history, using things like rap songs about the Albee Square Mall by Biz Markie, using oral histories of folks who have actually had businesses in the area for the last 20 years. So do very current, recent oral histories and use many multimedia kind of things to bring together that experience.
My guest on WNYC, as we talk about issues raised by the show called Mind the Gap at the Smack Mellon Gallery in Dumbo, are Ava Diaz, co-curator, and two representatives of the Center for Urban Pedagogy, or CUP, who are represented in the show by their work about the Fulton Street Mall, Damon Rich, the co-founder and creative director of CUP, and Rostin Wu, who was just speaking, CUP's director of programs. And we can't sneak in a few phone calls. If anybody's seen this show in Dumbo or the CUP installation at the Fulton Street Mall, or if you have a question or comment for the guest, or anybody who just wants to talk about the Fulton Street Mall as an example of Damon certainly thinks it's successful urbanism in New York City, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, and can art be a force for both good and gentrification? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Ava, I wonder if you think artists who moved to Dumbo got taken by a kind of bait and switch. We only need you as a transition to luxury housing, and even though subsidies were offered at that time by people connected with your gallery.
Well, you know, I'm not abreast of all of the kind of issues of how specifically gentrification has happened in Dumbo, but as you mentioned, artists and cultural producers are often the pioneers of the frontier of gentrification. So, you know, there's definitely, I mean, the East Village in the 80s, Soho in the 70s, there's been, as you mentioned, a history of these things happening. But this really should change at a legislative level. I mean, rent control laws should be altered and the loft law should be extended to Brooklyn so that people who build out these spaces have the right to stay there and aren't displaced by sort of the luxury condos and the kind of waterfront and other forms of development happening in Brooklyn that are extending gentrification beyond the Soho model.
A lot of what this exhibit is about is what you might call public art, but not in the typical sense of monumental sculptures adorning a plaza,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this idea of the liminal is a way to kind of see, to activate the public spaces and to see, you know, artists are participating in, you know, sort of taking an idea of public art that really is in the fullest sense public, that takes up issues of the public, homelessness, development, and doesn't just function, as you said, as a sort of ornamental, large-scale decorative sculpture filling up a space, but that actually, you know, in a self-reflexive manner engages with the kinds of public issues that that are of concern to that neighborhood and to others.
Damon Rich, you want to talk more about Fulton Street? Are there plans to, quote, improve the mall?
Well, there's no really specific plans right now. As you mentioned, the Pratt Center for Community Development has just released a white paper recently looking at what might be some ways forward in the future of the mall. And that was specifically put together by some very progressive preservationists who were looking at not only how do you preserve the buildings of the mall, but how do you identify and preserve the cultural aspects and the social uses of the mall that are really treasured by the community that's there. We were interested in terms of bringing this to Dumbo, which I think some people have asked us about, because Dumbo is, as you mentioned, a very, very different neighborhood than is Fulton Mall. Even though there might be some overlaps between the constituency of Fulton Mall and that of Dumbo, there's also some areas that do not overlap. And I think we were interested in this idea and provoked by Beth and Eva's notion of the urban gap. And we, I think, specifically wanted to bring our work about Fulton Mall to the show to make the point that even though these areas are interesting, inviting, exciting, there's also a danger in romanticizing this idea of the urban void, and that oftentimes artists are, in fact, some of the most guilty ones about thinking about vacant spaces and not realizing the political motivations behind those kinds of labels.
And Damon, I noticed on your bio that you're working on a history of urban renewal, so I would guess you might have something to say about the passing of Jane Jacobs.
Indeed. I mean, it was good to hear your previous guest talk about her and pay tribute to her legacy. And, you know, I want to endorse that tribute. At the same time, I think something that's interesting, as you were discussing the activities of the LMDC down at Ground Zero, I think at this point, we're kind of living in a world that Jane Jacobs made for good and very much, I think, in the present for bad, in the sense that when you read the newspapers, every new development, it seems, is advertised with the slogan of having 24-hour, mixed-use, vibrant street life. And, you know, I think that in some ways the struggle for people who are involved in community development today is to somehow see through that rhetoric, which really surrounds us. You know, I think whether you're talking about Lower Manhattan development, Brooklyn development at the time when they were talking about the Jet Stadium, it was the same thing. So in some ways, I think today what we've seen, the taking up by the powers that be and very much by the development establishment of her legacy. And hopefully, you know, there will be some success in sort of saving her legacy from that, that bastardization of it.
Right. Well, the architecture critics who we had on said they never heard her talk about it, but they would be sure that Jane Jacobs would not approve of the Atlantic Yards project. So what you think is that the developers are using her language and co-opting it?
To a certain extent. I mean, although I think that Jane Jacobs, you know, everyone loves Jane Jacobs. At the same time, I think today we have to be honest about the limitations of her work. She was a white, you know, middle-class woman who succeeded in organizing other middle-class people to a great extent to get media coverage. I mean, she worked in the media. There were a lot of things that that made her able to do what she did. In fact, I just was able to deliver a paper last fall that was speculating on what really accounts for her meteoric rise to fame through the 60s into the 70s. I mean, as early as the early 70s, you have a new commissioner of planning in New York City, Zuccotti, who claims to be a disciple of Jane Jacobs. And it's kind of an amazing thing to think that someone who is, you know, theoretically such an outsider at the beginning became such a, you know, hegemonic force.
David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi, I'm an artist and I've been living in Brooklyn. I'm originally from the Bronx and I've been living here for a while. And I used to live in the East Village in the early 80s and then in Soho, and I've lived all around. And right now I'm just really struck by the idea that for me this is a political and economic problem, because the powers that be are basically using this to, like Marky Markowitz is using this as, I think, a stepping stone towards something else in a lot of ways, and it's not helping the neighborhood whatsoever. It's simply a monetary gain and political gain for him. And what I guess one of my main comments is that, as an artist, understanding that we have, as the other speaker had said, you know, basically broken ground throughout. Whether, you know, I lived in the East Village or Fort Greene and now Borham Hill, it's each time we're breaking it through. And now I can't afford to move anywhere,
yeah,
unless I'm going to pioneer a new place. And because of that, the infrastructure, the quality of being an artist has changed so drastically over the last 25 years, where artists can't make work, or what they have to do to make work changes the basic structure of how art exists in the city. And, it, you know, they had that economic council, I think, recently about looking at how arts are actually dying in the city and how can we really make it a viable place again, because once it's gone, we've lost the cachet of what New York really is.
David, thank you very much for the call. And Rustin, do you agree very, very quickly? Or are there new frontiers for urban artists that you would name?
I would definitely not name any new frontiers for urban artists.
Some people say Fort George in the Bronx.
Well, you know, I think that the sort of underlying impetus to the show was to kind of see artists that are participating critically in this process of gentrification and to really, you know, to underscore that element.
One more thing real quick about the show. Sunday's the last day and it moves outside the gallery for a few things, including some kind of low-frequency ambulatory radio broadcast.
Mm-hmm,
we just have 20 seconds, but am I supposed to bring my Walkman?
Yeah, at 2 p.m. on Sunday, there's going to be neurotransmitters doing a low-frequency broadcast, as you mentioned, and it'll traverse spaces and to see radio waves themselves as a residual space of the city because, you know, they are highly licensed, and something like NPR is one of the few spaces where radio is free.
All right, the show is called Mind the Gap at the Smack Mellon Gallery in Dumbo. Ava Diaz, curator, Damon Rich, co-founder and creative director of the Center for Urban Pedagogy, Rustin Wu, director of programs at the center, who led the Fulton Street Project in this show. Thank you all for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.